child. And so for myself, rather than for her, I knelt by her body and scattered herbs, fragrant and bitter, leaves of rue and hyssop flowers, rosemary, thyme, and lavender. A bouquet from the living to the dead, small token of remembrance. Fed watched in silence, kneeling. Then she reached out and with gentle fingers laid the shroud across the girl's dead face. Jamie had come to watch. Without a word, he stooped and picked her up and bore her to the wagon. He didn't speak until I had climbed up and settled myself on the seat beside him. He snapped the reins on the horses' backs and clicked his tongue. "Let us go and find the sergeant," he said. There were, of course, a few things to be attended to first. We returned to River Run to leave Phedre, and Jamie disappeared to find Duncan and change his stained clothing, while I went to check on my patient and to acquaint Jocasta with the morning's events. I needn't have troubled on either account. Farquhar Campbell was sitting in the morning room sipping tea with Jocasta. John Myers, his loins swathed in a Cameron plaid, was lounging at full length upon the green velvet chaise, cheerfully munching scones. Judging from the unaccustomed cleanliness of the bare legs and feet extending from the tartan, someone had taken advantage of his temporary state of unconsciousness the night before to administer a bath. "My dear," Jocasta's head turned at my step, and she smiled, though I saw the twin lines of concern etched between her brows. "Sit you down, child, and take some nourishment. You'll have had no rest last night, and a dreadful morning, it seems." I might ordinarily have found it either amusing or insulting to be called child. Under the circumstances, it was oddly comforting. I sank gratefully into an armchair and let Ulysses pour me a cup of tea, wondering meanwhile just how much Farquhar had told Jocasta, and how much he knew. "How are you this morning?" I asked my patient. He appeared to be in amazingly good condition, considering his alcoholic intake of the night before. His colour was good, and so was his appetite, judging from the quantity of crumbs on the plate by his side. He nodded cordially at me, jaws champing, and swallowed with some effort.
"Astounding fine, ma'am, I thank you kindly. A mite sore round the privates."
He tenderly patted the area in question.
"But a sweeter job of stitching I've not been privileged to see. Mr. Ulysses was kind enough to fetch me a looking-glass," he explained.
He shook his head in some awe.
"Never seen my own behind before. As much hair as I got back there, you'd think my daddy'd been a bear."
He laughed heartily at this, and Farquhar Campbell buried a smile in his teacup. Ulysses turned away with the tray, but I saw the corners of his mouth twitch. Jocasta laughed out loud, blind eyes crinkling in amusement.
"They do say it's a wise bairn that kens its father, Joan Quincy. But I kent your mother weel, and I'll say I think it unlikely."
Myers shook his head, but his eyes twinkled over the thick growth of beard.
"Well, my mamma did admire a hairy man. Said it was a rare comfort on a cold winter's night."
He peered down the open neck of his shirt, viewing the underbrush on display with some satisfaction.
"Might be so at that. The Indian lassies seem to like it, though it's maybe only the novelty, come to think on it. Their own men scarcely got fuzz on their balls, let alone their backsides."
Mr. Campbell inhaled a fragment of scone and coughed heavily into his napkin. I smiled to myself and took a deep swallow of tea. It was a strong and fragrant Indian blend, and despite the oppressive heat of the morning, more than welcome. A light dew of sweat broke out on my face as I drank, but the warmth settled comfortingly into my uneasy stomach, the perfume of the tea driving the stench of blood and excreta from my nose, even as the cheerful conversation banished the morbid scenes of the morning from my mind. I eyed the hearth rug wistfully. I felt as though I could lie down there peacefully and sleep for a week.
"No rest for the weary, though."
Jamie came in, freshly shaved and combed, dressed in sober coat and clean linen. He nodded to Farquhar Campbell with no apparent surprise. He must have heard his voice from the hallway.
"Auntie."
He bent and kissed Jocasta's cheek in greeting, then smiled at Myers.
"How is it, Acharad? Or shall I say, how are they?" "Right as rain," Myers assured him.
He cupped a hand consideringly between his legs.
"Think I might wait a day or two before I climb back on a horse, though."
"I would," Jamie assured him.
He turned back to Jocasta.
"Have you maybe seen Duncan this morning, Auntie?"
"Oh, aye. He's gone a small errand for me, he and the laddie."
She smiled and reached for him. I saw her fingers wrapped tight around his wrist.
"Such a dear man, Mr. Innes. So helpful. And such a quick, canny man. A real pleasure to talk to. Do you not find him so, nephew?"
Jamie glanced at her curiously. Then his gaze flicked to Farquhar Campbell. The older man avoided his eye, sipping at his tea as he affected to study the large painting that hung above the mantel.
"Indeed," Jamie said dryly. "A useful man is Duncan. And young Ian's gone with him."
"To fetch your bitty package for me," his aunt said placidly. "Did you need Duncan directly?"
"No," Jamie said slowly, staring down at her. "It can wait."
Her fingers slipped free of his sleeve, and she reached for her teacup. The delicate handle was angled precisely toward her, ready for her hand.
"That's good," she said. "You'll have a bite of breakfast then. And, Farquhar, another scone?" "Ah, no. Hyambincor tapale. I've business in the town, and best I be about it."
Campbell set down his cup and got to his feet, bowing to me and to Jocasta in turn.
"Your servant, ladies, Mr. Fraser," he added with a lift of one brow,
and bowing, he followed Ulysses out. Jamie sat down, his own brows raised, and reached for a piece of toast.
"Your errand, aunt. Duncan's gone to find the slave woman."
"He has." Jocasta turned her blind eyes toward him, frowning.
"You'll not mind, Jamie. I ken Duncan's your man, but it seemed an urgent matter, and I couldna be sure when you'd come."
"What did Campbell tell you?"
I could tell what Jamie was thinking. It seemed out of character for the upright and rigid Mr. Campbell, justice of the district, who wouldn't stir a hand to prevent a gruesome lynching, to conspire for the protection of a female slave and an abortionist to boot. And yet, perhaps he meant it as compensation for what he hadn't been able to prevent before. The handsome shoulders moved in the slightest of shrugs, and a muscle dipped near the corner of her mouth.
"I've kent Farquhar Campbell these 20 years, avec mo frère. I hear what he doesna say better than what he does."
Myers had been following this exchange with interest.
"Couldn't say as my own ears are that good," he observed mildly. "All I heard him say was how some poor woman killed herself by accident up to the mill, trying to rid herself of a burden. He said he didn't know her himself."
He smiled blandly at me.
"And that alone tells me the lass is a stranger," Jocasta observed. "Farquhar knows the folk on the river and in the town as well as I ken my own folk. She is no one's daughter, no one's servant."
She set down her cup and leaned back in her chair with a sigh.
"It will be all right," she said. "Eat up your food, lad. You must be starving."
Jamie stared at her for a moment, the piece of toast uneaten in his hand. He leaned forward and dropped it back on the plate.
"I canna see of much appetite just now, Auntie. Dead lassies curdle my weem a bit."
He stood up, brushing down the skirts of his coat.
"She's maybe no one's daughter or servant, but she's lying in the yard just now, drawing flies. I'd have a name for her before I bury her."
He turned on his heel and stalked out.
I drained the last of my tea and set the cup back with a faint chime of bone china.
Sorry, I said apologetically. I don't believe I'm hungry either.
Jocasta neither moved nor changed expression. As I left the room, I saw Myers lean over from his chaise and neatly snag the last of the scones. It was nearly noon before we reached the Crown's warehouse at the end of Hay Street. It stood on the north side of the river, with its own pier for loading, a little way above the town itself. There seemed little necessity for a guard at the moment. Nothing moved in the vicinity of the building, save a few sulphur butterflies, who, unaffected by the smothering heat, were diligently labouring among the flowering bushes that grew thick along the shore. "What do they keep here?" I asked Jamie, looking curiously up at the massive structure. The huge double doors were shut and bolted, the single red-coated sentry motionless as a tin soldier in front of them. A smaller building beside the warehouse sported an English flag, drooping limply in the heat. Presumably, this was the lair of the sergeant we were seeking. Jamie shrugged and brushed a questing fly away from his eyebrow. We had been attracting more and more of them as the heat of the day increased, despite the movement of the wagon. I sniffed discreetly, but could smell only a faint hint of thyme.
"Whatever the Crown thinks valuable. Furs from the back country, naval stores, pitch and turpentine. But the guard is because of the liquor."
While every inn brewed its own beer, and every household had its receipts for applejack and cherry wine, the more potent spirits were the province of the Crown. Brandy, whiskey, and rum were imported to the colony in small quantities under heavy guard, and sold at great cost under the Crown's seal.
"I should say they haven't got much in stock right now," I said, nodding at the single guard.
"No. The shipments of liquor come upstream from Wilmington once a month. Campbell says they choose a different day each time, so as to run less risk of robbery."
He spoke abstractedly, a small frown lingering between his eyebrows.
"Did Campbell believe us, do you think? About her doing it herself?"
Without really meaning to, I cast a half-glance into the wagon behind me. Jamie made a derisory Scottish noise in the back of his throat.
"Course not, Sassenach. The man's no a fool. But he's a good friend to my aunt. He'll not make trouble if he doesn't have to. Let's hope the woman had no one who'll make a fuss."
"Rather a cold-blooded hope," I said quietly. "I thought you felt differently in your aunt's drawing-room." "You're probably right, though. If she'd had someone, she wouldn't be dead now."
He heard the bitterness in my voice and looked down at me.
"I didn't mean to be callous, Sassenach," he said gently. "But the poor lassie is dead. I cannae do more for her than see her decently into the ground. It's the living I must take heed for, aye?"
I heaved a sigh and squeezed his arm briefly. My feelings were a good deal too complex to try to explain. I had known the girl no more than minutes before her death, and could in no way have prevented it. But she had died under my hands, and I felt the physician's futile rage in such circumstances. The feeling that somehow I had failed had been outwitted by the dark angel. And beyond rage and pity was an echo of unspoken guilt. The girl was near Brianna's age. Brianna, who, in like circumstances, would also have no one. "I know. It's only... I suppose I feel responsible for her, in a way."
"So do I," he said. "Never fear, Sassenach. We'll see she's done rightly by."
He reined the horses in under a chestnut tree, and swung down, offering me a hand. There were no barracks. Campbell had told Jamie that the warehouse guard's 10 men were quartered in various houses in the town. Upon inquiry of the clerk labouring in the office, we were directed across the street to the sign of the Golden Goose, where the sergeant might presently be found at his luncheon. I saw the sergeant in question at once as I entered the tavern. He was sitting at a table by the window,
his white leather stock undone and his tunic unbuttoned, looking thoroughly relaxed over a mug of ale and the remains of a Cornish pasty. Jamie came in behind me, his shadow momentarily blocking the light from the open door, and the sergeant looked up. Dim as it was in the taproom, I could see the man's face go blank with shock. Jamie came to an abrupt halt behind me. He said something in Gaelic under his breath that I recognized as a vicious obscenity. But then he was moving forward past me, with no signs of hesitation in his manner.
"Sergeant Murchison," he said,
in tones of mild surprise, as one might greet a casual acquaintance.
"I hadn't a thought to lay eyes on you again. Not in this world, at least."
The sergeant's expression strongly suggested that the feeling had been mutual. Also, that any meeting this side of heaven was too soon. Blood flooded his beefy, pockmarked cheeks with red, and he shoved back his bench with a screech of wood on the sanded floor.
"You," he said.
Jamie took off his hat and inclined his head politely.
"Your servant, sir," he said.
I could see his face now, outwardly pleasant, but with a wariness that creased the corners of his eyes. He showed it a good deal less, but the sergeant wasn't the only one to be taken aback. Murchison was regaining his self-possession, though a look of shock was replaced by a faint sneer.
"Fraser. Oh, beg pardon. Mr. Fraser it'll be now, won't it?" "It will."
Jamie kept his voice neutral, despite the insulting tone of this. Whatever past conflict lay between them, the last thing he wanted now was trouble. Not with what lay in the wagon outside. I wiped my sweaty palm surreptitiously on my skirt. The sergeant had begun to do up his tunic buttons, slowly, not taking his eyes off Jamie.
"I had heard there was a man called Fraser, come to leech off Mistress Cameron at River Run," he said, with an unpleasant twist of thick lips. "That'll be you, will it?"
The wariness in Jamie's eyes froze into a blue as cold as glacier ice, though his lips stayed curved in a pleasant smile.
"Mistress Cameron will be my kinswoman. It is on her behalf that I have come now."
The sergeant tilted back his head and scratched voluptuously at his throat. There was a deep, hard-edged red crease across the expanse of fat, pale flesh, as though someone had tried unsuccessfully to garrote the man.
"Your kinswoman. Well, easy to say so, ain't it? The lady's blind as a bat, I hear. No husband, no sons. Fair prey for any sharpster comes a-calling claiming family."
The sergeant lowered his head and smirked at me, his self-possession fully restored.
"And this'll be your doxy, will it?"
It was gratuitous malice, a shot at random. The man had scarcely glanced at me.
"This will be my wife, Mistress Fraser."
I could see the two stiff fingers of Jamie's right hand twitch once against the skirt of his coat, the only outward sign of his feelings. He tilted his head back an inch and raised his brows, considering the sergeant with an air of dispassionate interest.
"And which one are you, sir? I beg pardon for my imperfect recollection, but I confess that I cannot tell you from your brother."
The sergeant stopped as though he'd been shot, frozen in the act of fastening his stock.
"Damn you," he said,
choking on the words. His face had gone an unhealthy shade of plum, and I thought that he ought really to mind his blood pressure. I didn't say so, though. At this point, the sergeant seemed to notice that everyone in the taproom was staring at him with great interest. He glared ferociously around him, snatched up his hat, and stamped toward the door, pushing past me as he went, so that I staggered back a pace. Jamie grabbed my arm to steady me, then ducked beneath the lintel himself. I followed, in time to see him call after the sergeant.
"Murchison, a word with you."
The soldier whirled on his heel, hands fisted against the skirts of his scarlet coat. He was a good-sized man, thick through torso and shoulder, and the uniform became him. His eyes glittered with menace, but
but he had gained possession of himself again.
"A word, is it?"
he said.
"And what might you have to say to me, Mr. Fraser?"
"A word in your professional capacity, Sergeant," Jamie said coolly.
He nodded toward the wagon, which we had left beneath a nearby tree.
"We've brought you a corpse."
For the second time, the sergeant's face went blank. He glanced at the wagon. Flies and gnats had begun to gather in small clouds, circling lazily over the open bed.
"Indeed."
He was a professional. While the hostility of his manner was undiminished, the hot blood faded from his face and the clenched fists relaxed.
"A corpse? Whose?"
"I've no idea, sir. It was my hope that you might be able to tell us. Will you, Luke?"
He nodded toward the wagon, and after a moment's hesitation, the sergeant nodded briefly back and strode toward the wagon. I hurried after Jamie, and was in time to see the sergeant's face as he drew back the corner of the makeshift shroud. He had no skill at all in hiding his feelings. Perhaps in his profession it wasn't necessary. Shock flickered over his face like summer lightning. Jamie could see the sergeant's face as well as I.
"You'll know her then," he said. Yes, I know her."
The sergeant's mouth snapped shut abruptly, as though he was afraid to let any more words out. He continued to stare at the girl's dead face, his own tightening, freezing out all feeling. A few men had followed us out of the tavern. While they stayed at a discreet distance, two or three were craning their necks with curiosity. It wasn't going to be long before the whole district knew what had happened at the mill. I hoped Duncan and Ian were well on their way.
"What's happened to her?"
the sergeant asked, staring down at the fixed white face. His own was nearly as pale. Jamie was watching him intently, and making no pretense otherwise.
"You'll know her then," he said again. She was, a laundress. Lissa Garver is her name."
The sergeant spoke mechanically, still looking down into the wagon as though unable to tear his eyes away. His face was expressionless, but his lips were white, and his hands were clenched into fists at his sides.
"What happened?" "Has she people in the town? A husband, maybe?"
It was a reasonable question, but Murchison's head jerked up as though Jamie had stabbed him with it.
"None of your concern, is it?" he said.
He stared at Jamie, a thin rim of white visible around the iris of his eye. He bared his teeth in what might have been politeness, but wasn't.
"Tell me what happened to her."
Jamie's eyes met the sergeant's without blinking.
"She meant to slip a bairn, and it went wrong," he said quietly. "If she has a husband, he must be told. If not, if she has no people, I will see her decently buried."
Murchison turned his head to look down into the wagon once more.
"She has someone,"
he said shortly.
"You needn't trouble yourself."
He turned away and rubbed a hand over his face, scrubbing violently as though to wipe away all feeling.
"Go to my office," he said,
voice half muffled.
"You must make a statement, see the clerk. Go!"
The office was empty, a clerk, no doubt, gone in search of his own luncheon. I sat down to wait, but Jamie prowled restlessly around the small room, eyes flitting from the regimental banners on the wall to the drawered cabinet in the corner behind the desk.
"Damn the luck," he said half to himself. "It would have to be Murchison."
"I take it you know the sergeant well?" He glanced at me with a wry quirk of the lips.
"Well enough. He was in the garrison at Ardsmuir Prison."
"I see." No love lost between them, then. It was close in the little office. I blotted a trickle of sweat that ran down between my breasts.
"What do you suppose he's doing here?"
"That much I can. He was sent in charge of the prisoners when they were transported to be sold. I imagine the Crown saw no good reason to bring him back to England when there was need of soldiers here. That would have been during the war with the French, aye?
What was that business about his brother?
He snorted, a brief, humourless sound.
There were two of them, twins. Wee Billy and Wee Bobby, we called them. Alike as peas, and not only in looks.
He paused, marshalling memories. He didn't often speak of his time in Ardsmuir, and I could see the shadows of it pass across his face.
You'll maybe know the sort of man is decent enough on his own, but get him with others like him, and they might as well be wolves.
Bit hard on the wolves, I said, smiling.
Think of Rollo. But yes, I know what you mean. Pigs, then. But beasts when they're together. There's no lack of such men in any army. That's why armies work. Men will do terrible things in a mob that they wouldn't dream of on their own.
And the Murchisons were never on their own? I asked slowly. He gave me a slight nod of acknowledgement.
Aye, that's it. There were the two of them, always. And what one might scruple at, the other would not. And of course, when it came to trouble, why, there was no saying which was to blame, was there?
He was still prowling, restless as a caged panther. He paused by the window, looking out.
Aye, the prisoners. We might complain of ill treatment, but the officers couldn't have disciplined both for the sins of one. And the man seldom knew which Murchison it was that had had him on the ground wi' a boot in the ribs, or which it was that hung him from a hook by his fetters, and left him so, until he'd soil himself for the amusement of the garrison.
His eyes were fixed on something outside, his expression unguarded. He'd spoken of beasts. I could see that the memories had roused one. His eyes caught the light from the window, gem blue and unblinking.
"Are both of them here?" I asked, as much to break that unnerving stare as because I wanted to know.
It worked. He turned abruptly from the window.
"No," he said. "This is Billy. Wee Bobby died at Ardsmuir."
His two stiff fingers twitched against the fabric of his kilt.
It had occurred to me briefly to wonder why he had worn his kilt this morning, instead of changing to breeks. The crimson tartan might be quite literally a red flag to a bull, flaunted thus before an English soldier. Now I knew. They'd taken it from him once before, thinking to take with it pride and manhood. They had failed in that attempt, and he meant to underscore that failure, whether it was sense to do so or not. Sense had little to do with a sort of stubborn pride that could survive years of such insult. And while he had more than his share of both, I could see that pride was well in the ascendancy at present.
From the sergeant's reactions, I suppose we may assume it wasn't natural causes, I asked.
No, he said.
He sighed and shrugged his shoulders slightly, easing them inside the tight coat.
They marched us out to the stone quarry each morning, and back again at twilight, we two or three guards to each wagon. One day, wee Bobby Murchison was the sergeant in charge. He came out wi' us in the morning, but he didna come back wi' us at night.
He glanced once more at the window.
There was a very deep pool at the bottom of the quarry.
His matter-of-fact tone was nearly as chilling as the content of this bald account. I felt a small shiver pass up my spine, in spite of the stifling heat.
"Did you?"
I began. But he put a finger to his lips, jerking his head toward the door.
A moment later, I heard the footsteps that his keener ears had picked up.
It was the sergeant, not his clerk. He had been perspiring heavily, streaks of sweat ran down his face beneath his wig, and his whole countenance was the unhealthy colour of fresh beef liver. He glanced at the vacant desk and made a small vicious noise in his throat. I felt a qualm on behalf of the absent clerk. The sergeant shoved aside the clutter on the desk with a sweep of his arm that sent paper cascading onto the floor. He snatched a pewter inkwell and a sheet of foolscap from the rubble and banged them down on the desk.
"Write it down," he ordered, "where you found her, what happened."
He thrust a spattered goose quill at Jamie.
"Sign it. Date it."
Jamie stared at him, eyes narrowed, but made no move to take the quill. I felt a sudden sinking in my belly. Jamie was left-handed, but had been taught forcibly to write with his right hand, and then had that right hand crippled. Writing for him was a slow, laborious business that left the pages blotted, sweat-stained, and crumpled, and the writer himself in no better case. There was no power on earth that would make him humiliate himself in that fashion before the sergeant.
"Write it down."
The sergeant bit off the words between his teeth. Jamie's eyes narrowed further, but before he could speak, I reached out and snatched the pen from the sergeant's grasp.
"I was there. Let me do it."
Jamie's hand closed on mine before I could dip the quill in the inkwell. He plucked the pen from my fingers and dropped it in the center of the desk.
"Your clerk can wait upon me later at my aunt's house," he said briefly to Murchison. "Come with me, Claire."
Not waiting for an answer from the sergeant, he grasped my elbow and all but pulled me to my feet. We were outside before I knew what had happened. The wagon still stood under the tree, but now it was empty.
"Well, she's safe for the moment, McDo, but what in hell shall we do with the woman?"
Duncan scratched at the stubble on his chin. He and Ian had spent 3 days in the forest searching before finding the slave Pollyann.
"She'll no be easy to move,"
Ian put in, snaring a piece of bacon off the breakfast table. He broke it in half and handed one piece to Rollo.
"The poor lady near died of terror when Rollo sniffed her out, and we had God's own time getting her on her feet. We couldn't have get her on a horse at all. I had to walk with my arm around her to keep her from falling down."
"We must get her clear away somehow,"
Jocasta frowned, blank eyes half-hooded in thought.
"Young Murchison was at the mill again yesterday morning, making a nuisance of himself, and last night Farquhar Campbell sent to tell me that the man has declared it was murder, and he's called for men to search the district for the slave who did it. Farquhar's so hot under his collar, I thought his head would burst into flame."
"Do you think she could have done it?"
Chewing, Ian looked from Jamie to me.
"By accident, I mean."
In spite of the hot morning, I shuddered, feeling in memory the unyielding stiffness of the metal skewer in my hand.
"You have three possibilities: accident, murder, or suicide," I said. "There are lots easier ways of committing suicide, believe me, and no motive for murder that we know of."
"Be that as it may," Jamie said, neatly fielding the conversation. "If Murchison takes the slave woman, he'll have her hanged or flogged to death within a day. He's no need of trial. No, we must take her clear out of the district. I've arranged it with our friend Myers."
"You've arranged what with Myers?"
Jocasta asked sharply, her voice cutting through the babble of exclamations and questions that greeted this announcement. Jamie finished buttering the piece of toast that he held and handed it to Duncan before speaking.
"We shall take the woman into the mountains," he said. "Myers says she'll be welcome among the Indians. He kens a good place for her, he says. And she'll be safe there from wee Billy Murchison."
"We?" I asked politely. "And who's we?"
He grinned at me in reply.
"Myers and myself, Sassenach. I need to go to the back country to have a look before the cold weather comes, and this will be a good chance. Myers is the best guide I could have."
He carefully refrained from noting that it might be as well for him to be temporarily out of Sergeant Murchison's sphere of influence, but the implication wasn't lost on me.
"You'll take me, will you not, Uncle?"
Ian brushed the matted hair out of his face, looking eager.
"You'll need help with that woman, believe me. She's the size of a molasses barrel."
Jamie smiled at his nephew.
"Aye, Ian. I expect we can use another man along.
Ahem, I said, giving him an evil stare.
To keep an eye on your auntie, if nothing else, Jamie continued, giving the stare back to me. We leave in 3 days, Sassenach, if Myers can sit a horse by then.
3 days didn't allow much time, but with the assistance of Myers and Phedre, my preparations were completed with hours to spare. I had a small travelling box of medicines and tools, and the saddlebags were packed with food, blankets, and cooking implements. The only small matter remaining was that of a tire. I recrossed the ends of the long silk strip across my chest, tied the ends in a jaunty knot between my breasts, and examined the results in the looking-glass. Not bad. I extended my arms and jiggled my torso from side to side, testing. Yes, that would do. Though perhaps if I took one more turn around my chest before crossing the ends...
What exactly are you doing, Sassenach? And what in the name of God are you wearing?
Jamie, arms crossed, was leaning against the door, watching me with both brows raised. I am improvising a brazier, I said with dignity. I don't mean to ride side-saddle through the mountains wearing a dress, and if I'm not wearing stays, I don't mean my breasts to be joggling all the way, either. Most uncomfortable, joggling.
I dare see.
He edged into the room and circled me at a cautious distance, eyeing my nether limbs with interest.
And what are those?
Like them. I put my hands on my hips, modelling the drawstring leather trousers that Phedre had constructed for me, laughing hysterically as she did so, from soft buckskin provided by one of Myers' friends in Cross Creek.
No, he said bluntly. You cannot be going about in...
He waved at them, speechless. Trousers, I said. And of course I can. I wore trousers all the time back in Boston. They're very practical. He looked at me in silence for a moment. Then, very slowly, he walked around me. At last, his voice came from behind me.
You wore them outside, he said, in tones of incredulity. Where folk could see you.
I did, I said crossly. So did most other women. Why not?
Why not? He said, scandalized. I can see the whole shape of your buttocks, for God's sake, and the cleft between.
I can see yours, too, I pointed out, turning around to face him. I've been looking at your backside in breeks every day for months, but only occasionally does the sight move me to make indecent advances on your person. His mouth twitched, undecided whether to laugh or not. Taking advantage of the indecision, I took a step forward and put my arms around his waist, firmly cupping his backside.
Actually, it's your kilt that makes me want to fling you to the floor and commit ravishment, I told him. But you don't look at all bad in your breeks.
He did laugh then, and bending, kissed me thoroughly, his hands carefully exploring the outlines of my rear, snugly confined in buckskin. He squeezed gently, making me squirm against him.
"Take them off," he said, pausing for air.
"But I..."
"Take them off," he repeated firmly.
He stepped back and tugged loose the lacing of his flies.
"You can put them back on again after, Sassenach. But if there's flinging and ravishing to be done, it'll be me that does it, aye?"
Part 5. Strawberry Fields Forever. Chapter 14. Flee from Wrath to Come. August 1767. They had hidden the woman in a tobacco shed on the edge of Farquhar Campbell's farthest fields. There was little chance of anyone noticing, other than Campbell's slaves, who already knew. But we took care to arrive just after dark, when the lavender sky had faded nearly to grey, barely outlining the dark bulk of the drying shed. The woman slid out like a ghost, cloaked and hooded, and was hoisted onto the extra horse, bundled hastily aboard like the package of contraband she was. She drew up her legs and clung to the saddle with both hands, doubled up in a ball of panic.
Evidently, she'd never been on a horse before. Myers tried to hand her the reins, but she paid no attention, only clung tight and moaned in a sort of melodic agony of terror. The men were becoming restive, glancing over their shoulders into the empty fields, as though expecting the imminent arrival of Sergeant Murchison and his minions. "Let her ride with me," I suggested. "Maybe she feels safer that way." The woman was detached from her mount with some difficulty and set down on the horse's rump behind my saddle. She smelt strongly of fresh tobacco leaves, pungently narcotic, and something else, a little muskier. She at once flung her arms around my waist, holding on for dear life. I patted one of the hands clutched about my middle, and she squeezed tighter, but made no other move or sound. Little wonder if she was terrified, I thought, turning my horse's head to follow Myers. She might not know about the hullabaloo Murchison was raising in the district, but she could have no illusions about what might happen if she was caught. She had certainly been among the crowd at the sawmill 2 weeks earlier. As an alternative to certain death, flight into the arms of red savages might be slightly preferable, but not by much, to judge from her trembling. The weather was far from cold, but she shook as though with chill. She nearly squeezed the stuffings out of me when Rollo appeared, stalking out of the bushes like some demon of the forest. My horse didn't like the look of him either, and backed up, snorting and stamping, trying to jerk the reins away from me. I had to admit that Rollo was reasonably fearsome, even when he was in an amiable mood, which he was at the moment. Rollo loved expeditions. Still, he undoubtedly presented a sinister aspect. All his teeth were showing in a grin of delight, his slitted eyes half closed as he whiffed the air. Add to that the way the greys and blacks of his coat faded into the shadows, and one was left with a queer and unsettling illusion that he had materialized out of the substance of the night, appetite incarnate. He trotted directly past us, no more than a foot away, and the woman gasped, her breath hot on my neck. I patted her hand again and spoke to her, but she made no answer. Duncan had said she was Africa-born and spoke little English, but surely she must understand a few words. "It will be all right," I said again. "Don't be afraid." Occupied with horse and passenger, I hadn't noticed Jamie until he appeared suddenly by my stirrup, light-footed as Rollo. "All right, Sassenach," he asked softly, putting a hand on my thigh. "I think so," I said. I nodded at the death grip round my middle. "If I don't die of suffocation." He looked and smiled. "Well, she's in no danger of falling off, at least." "I wish I knew something to say to her, poor thing. She's so afraid. Do you suppose she even knows where we're taking her?"
"I shouldn't think so. I dunno ken where we're going."
He wore breeks for riding, but had his plaid belted over them, the free end slung across the shoulder of his coat. The dark tartan blended into the shadows of the forest, as well as it had the shades of the Scottish heather. All I could see of him was a white blotch of shirt front and the pale oval of his face. "Do you know any useful taki-taki to say to her?" I asked. "Of course, she might not know that either if she wasn't brought through the Indies." He turned his head and looked up at my passenger, considering.
"Ah," he said. "Well, there's one thing they'll all know, no matter where they've come."
He reached out and squeezed the woman's foot firmly.
"Freedom," he said, and paused. "Sorsa, d'ye ken what I see?"
She didn't loosen her grip, but her breath went out in a shuddering sigh, and I thought I felt her nod. The horses followed each other in single file, Myers in the lead. The rough track wasn't even a wagon trail, only a sort of flattening of undergrowth, but it did at least provide clear passage through the trees. I doubted that Sergeant Murchison's vengeance would pursue us so far, if he pursued us at all, but the sense of escape was too strong to ignore. We shared an unspoken but pervasive sense of urgency, and with no particular discussion, agreed to ride on as far as possible.
My passenger was either losing her fear or simply becoming too tired to care any more. After a midnight stop for refreshment, she allowed Ian and Myers to boost her back on the horse without protest. And while she never released her hold on my waist, she did seem to doze now and then, her forehead pressed against my shoulder. The fatigue of long riding crept over me, too, aided by the hypnotic soft thudding of the horse's feet and the unending susurrus of the pines overhead. We were still in the longleaf forest, and the tall, straight trunks surrounded us like the masts of long-sunk ships. Lines of an ancient Scottish song drifted through my mind. How many strawberries grow in the salt sea? How many ships sail in the forest? And I wondered muzzily whether the composer had walked through a place like this, unearthly in half-moon and starlight, so dreamlike that the borders between the elements were lost. We might as well be afloat as earthbound. The heave and fall beneath me, the rise of planking, and the sound of the pines, the wind in our sails. We stopped at dawn, unsaddled the horses, hobbled them, and left them to feed in the long grass of a small meadow. I found Jamie, and curled up at once into a nest of grass beside him, the horse's peaceful champing the last thing I heard. We slept heavily through the heat of the day, and awoke near sunset, stiff, thirsty, and covered with ticks. I was profoundly thankful that the ticks seemed to share the mosquitoes' general distaste for my flesh, but I had learned on our trip north to check Jamie and the others every time we slept. There were always outriders. "Yick," I said, examining a particularly juicy specimen, the size of a grape, nestling amid the soft cinnamon hair of Jamie's underarm. "Damn! I'm afraid to pull that one. It's so full it'll likely burst." He shrugged, busy exploring his scalp with the other hand in search of further intruders.
"Leave it while you deal with the rest," he suggested. "Perhaps it'll fall off of its own accord."
"I suppose I'd better," I agreed reluctantly. I hadn't any objection to the tick's bursting, but not while its jaws were still embedded in Jamie's flesh. I'd seen infections caused by forcibly interrupted ticks, and they weren't anything I wanted to deal with in the middle of a forest. I had only a rudimentary medical kit with me, though this luckily included a very fine pair of small tweezer-pointed forceps from Dr. Rawling's box. Myers and Ian seemed to be managing all right. Both stripped to the waist, Myers was crouched over the boy like a huge black baboon, fingers busy in Ian's hair.
"Here's a wee one," Jamie said, bending over and pushing his own hair aside so I could reach the small dark bleb behind his ear.
I was engaged in gently manoeuvring the creature out when I became aware of a presence near my elbow. I'd been too tired to take much notice of our fugitive when we made camp, rightly assuming that she wasn't going to wander off into the wilderness by herself. She had wandered as far as a nearby stream, though, returning with a bucket of water. She set this on the ground, dipped up a handful of water, and funneled it into her mouth. She chewed vigorously for a moment, cheeks puffed out. Then she motioned me aside, and lifting a surprised Jamie's arm, spat forcefully and profusely into his armpit. She reached into the dripping hollow, and with delicate fingers appeared to tickle the parasite. She certainly tickled Jamie, who was very sensitive in that particular region. He turned pink in the face and flinched at her touch, all the muscles in his torso quivering. She held tight to his wrist, though, and within seconds the bulging tick dropped off into the palm of her hand. She flicked it disdainfully away and turned to me with a small air of satisfaction. I had thought she resembled a boar muffled in her cloak. Seen without it, she still did. She was very short, no more than 4 feet, and nearly as wide, with a close-cropped head like a cannonball, her cheeks so round that her eyes were slanted above them. She looked like nothing so much as one of the carved African fertility images I had seen in the Indies. Massive of bosom, heavy of haunch, and the rich burnt coffee colour of a Congolese,
with skin so flawless that it looked like polished stone under its thin layer of sweat. She held out her hand to me, showing me a few small objects in her palm, the general size and shape of dried lima beans.
"Pawpaw," she said,
in a voice so deep that even Myers turned his head toward her, startled. It was a huge, rich voice, reverberant as a drum. Seeing my reaction to it, she smiled a little shyly and said something I didn't quite understand, though I knew it was Gaelic.
"She says you mustn't swallow the seeds for their poison," Jamie translated,
eyeing her rather warily as he wiped his armpit with the end of his plaid.
"Oh,"
Pollyann agreed, nodding vigorously.
"Poison."
She stooped over the bucket for another handful of water, washed it round her mouth, and spat it at a rock with a noise like a gunshot. "You could be dangerous with that," I told her. I didn't know whether she understood me, but she gathered from my smile that I meant to be cordial. She smiled back, popped two more of the pawpaw seeds into her mouth, and beckoned to Myers, already chewing, the seeds making little crunching pops as she pulverized them between her teeth. By the time we had eaten supper and were ready to leave, she was nervously willing to try riding alone. Jamie coaxed her to the horse and showed her how to let the beast smell her. She trembled as the big nose nudged her, but then the horse snorted. She jumped, giggled in a voice like honey poured out of a jug, and allowed Jamie and Ian between them to boost her aboard. Pollyann remained shy of the men, but she soon gained enough confidence to talk to me in a polyglot mixture of Gaelic, English, and her own language. I couldn't have translated it, but both her face and body were so expressive that I could often gather the sense of what she was saying, even though I understood only one word in 10. I could only regret that I was not equally fluent in body language. She didn't understand most of my questions and remarks, so I had to wait until we made camp, when I could prevail on Jamie or Ian to help me with bits of Gaelic. Freed, at least temporarily, from the constraint of terror, and becoming cautiously secure in our company, a naturally effervescent personality emerged, and she talked with abandon as we rode side by side, regardless of my comprehension, laughing now and then with a low hooting noise like wind blowing across the mouth of a cave. She became subdued only once, when we passed through a large clearing where the grass rose in strange undulant mounds, as though a great serpent lay buried underneath. Pollyann went silent when she saw them, and in an effort to hurry her horse, instead succeeded only in pulling on the reins and stopping it dead. I rode back to help her.
"Drog haju,"
she murmured, glancing out of the corner of her eye at the silent mounds. "A bad place."
"Juju."
She scowled and made a small, quick gesture with her hand. Some sign against evil, I thought. "Is it a graveyard?" I asked Myers, who had circled back to see why we had stopped. The mounds weren't evenly spaced, but were distributed around the edge of the clearing in a pattern that didn't look like any natural formation. The mounds seemed too large to be graves, though, unless they were cairns, such as the ancient Scots built. Or mass graves, I thought, uneasy at the memory of Culloden.
"Not to say graveyard," he replied, pushing his hat back on his head. "'Twas a village once. Tuscarora, I expect. Those rises there,"
he waved a hand,
"those are houses fallen down. The big end to the side, that will have been the chief's longhouse. It be taken no time at all the grasses come over it. From the looks, though, this un'll have been buried a time back." "What happened to it?"
Ian and Jamie had stopped too and come back to look over the small clearing. Myers scratched thoughtfully at his beard.
"I couldn't be saying. Not for certain, sure. Might be a sickness drove em out. Might be as they were put to rout by the Cherokee or the Creek. Though we be a mite north of the Cherokee land. Most likely as it happened during the war, though."
He dug fiercely into his beard, twisted, and flicked away the remains of a lingering tick.
"Can't say as it's a place I'd tarry by choice."
Florian, being plainly of the same mind, we rode on. By evening we had passed entirely out of the pines and scrubby oakland of the foothills. We were climbing in good earnest now, and the trees began to change. Small groves of chestnut trees, large patches of oak and hickory, with scattered dogwood and persimmon, chinquapin and poplar, surrounded us in waves of feathery green. The smell and feel of the air changed too as we rose. The overwhelming hot resins of the pine trees gave way to lighter, more varied scents. Tree leaves mingled with whiffs of the shrubs and flowers that grew from every crevice of the craggy rocks. It was still damp and humid, but not so hot. The air no longer seemed a smothering blanket, but something we might breathe, and breathe with pleasure, filled as it was with the perfumes of leaf mould, sun-warmed leaves, and damp moss. By sunset of the sixth day, we were well into the mountains, and the air was full of the sound of running water. Streams criss-crossed the valleys, spilling off ridges and trickling down the steep rock faces, trailing mist and moss like a delicate green fringe. When we rounded the side of one steep hill, I stopped in amazement. From the side of a distant mountain, a waterfall leapt into the air, arching a good 80 feet in its fall to the gorge far below.
"Will you look at that now?"
Ian was open-mouthed with awe.
"'Tis right pretty,"
Myers allowed, with the smug complacence of a proprietor.
"Ain't the biggest falls I've seen, but it's nice enough."
Ian turned his head, eyes wide.
"There are bigger ones!"
Myers laughed, a mountain man's quiet laugh, no more than a breath of sound.
"Boy, you ain't seen nothing yet."
We camped for the night in a hollow near a good-sized creek. One big enough for trout. Jamie and Ian waded into this with enthusiasm, harrying the finny denizens with whippy rods cut from black willow. I hoped they would have some luck. Our fresh provisions were running low, though we still had plenty of cornmeal left. Pollyanne came scrambling up the bank, bringing a bucket of water with which to make a new batch of corn dodgers. These were small oblongs of rough cornmeal biscuit, made for travelling, tasty when fresh and hot, and at least edible the next day. They became steadily less appetizing with time, resembling nothing so much as small chunks of cement by the fourth day. Still, they were portable and not prone to mould, and thus were popular travelling fare along with dried beef and salt pork. Pollyanne's natural ebullience seemed a trifle subdued, her round face shadowed. Her eyebrows were so sketchy as to be almost non-existent, which had the paradoxical effect of increasing the expressiveness of her face in motion and wiping all expression from it in repose. She could be as impassive as a ball bearing when she wanted to, a useful skill for a slave. I suppose that her preoccupation was at least in part because this was the last night on which we would all be together. We had reached the back country, the limits of the king's land. Tomorrow, Myers would turn to the north, taking her across the spine of the mountains into the Indian lands, to find what safety and what life she might there. Her round dark head was bent over the wooden bowl, stubby fingers mixing cornmeal with water and lard. I crouched across from her, feeding small sticks to the infant fire, the black iron girdle standing ready-greased beside it. Myers had gone off to smoke a pipe. I could hear Jamie call to Ian somewhere downstream, and a faint answering laugh. It was deep twilight by now. Our hollow was ringed by brooding mountains, and darkness seemed to fill the shallow bowl, creeping up the trunks of the trees around us. I had no notion of the place she had come from, whether it might be forest or jungle, seashore or desert, but I thought it unlikely to be much like this. What could she be thinking? She had survived the journey from Africa and slavery. I supposed whatever lay ahead couldn't be much worse. It was an unknown future, though, going into a wilderness so vast and absolute that I felt every moment as though I might vanish into it, consumed without a trace.
Our fire seemed the merest spark against the vastness of the night.
Rollo strolled into the light of the fire and shook himself, spraying water in all directions, making the fire hiss and spit. He had joined in the fishing, I saw.
"Go away, horrible dog," I said.